Well, after hearing Phil talk, I'm somewhat overwhelmed that I'm going to be able to say anything quite as interesting for you guys. But thanks very much to Phil and Mark and the MFAA for giving me the opportunity to talk to you today. So what I'd like to do today is talk a bit about the present, the past, the present and the future of the mortgage market in Australia. So to some extent it's a bit of a history lesson, and some of you may be fairly familiar with the history. But I think it's useful to recount some of the history of the mortgage market to put what's going on in the market at the moment into a bit of context. I think some people forget when they're looking at the market now, it's not where it was in 2007, but it's also not where it was in 1996 either. I want to go through some of the history to give a bit of a perspective on what's actually going on in the market at the moment, and maybe give us some idea about how the market might evolve in the next little while. So I'm going to start with a bit of history, some of it going back a reasonable way. So back in the 60s and early 70s, the Australian financial system was heavily regulated. So beyond having to go begging to the local branch manager for a mortgage, there were a number of wide-ranging regulatory controls, including on the interest rates that banks could charge on their loans. There were also directives coming from us, because we used to supervise the banks in those days, on the overall quantity of loans that banks could make, as well as moral suasion as to who they could actually lend to. So these regulatory controls affected the bank's abilities to adjust to the changing conditions in the economy. It also imposed a cost disadvantage on the banks. So as a result of that, the banks lost market share to the unregulated financial sector, mostly in those days the building societies. So the bank's share of housing credit was just below 60% in 1976, with much of the rest of the mortgage market being provided by credit unions and building societies. So on this picture here, just splitting up the mortgage market, so the total amount of housing credit, into banks and credit unions and building societies, and then others who weren't very big, used to be finance companies back in the sort of 60s and 70s, and then more recently basically the wholesale lenders. So if you see right at the beginning of the picture there, the banks had less than 60% of the market, and the building societies, credit unions and building societies, having basically almost all the rest. So financial deregulation in Australia began slowly in the 1970s and then began accelerating quite sharply in the early 1980s. It affected the quantity of credit provided, the price it was provided at, as well as the structure of the mortgage market. So the main development, and this is maybe getting a little bit technical, but anyhow, was a reduction in something called the prescribed asset ratio. So that in those days, savings banks had to hold some chunk of their assets in the form of government debt. And then the rest of it they could lend out as housing loans primarily. So as that prescribed asset ratio was reduced, saving banks could actually increase the share of housing lending in their assets. On the pricing front, the interest rate ceiling on large housing loans was removed in the early 1970s, and then, if you might remember, in April 1986, there used to be a cap on interest on mortgage rates of 13.5%. And then that was finally removed in April 1986. One, in terms of the structure of the market, which is what I'm showing here, the distinction between savings banks and trading banks was removed in 1989. In the mid-1980s, 15 foreign banks were given licences to operate in the Australian market. Most of those foreign banks are still here today, but in the main, those guys focused on lending to businesses in those days rather than lending to households. So they didn't have much effect on the mortgage market. And the reason why they basically focused on lending to businesses rather than lending to households was because they didn't have a branch network. So back in the mid-1980s when the foreign banks came in, you guys, to some extent, weren't around quite as much. So mortgage brokers weren't out there, the internet wasn't out there. And as well as a bunch of financial innovation wasn't there, which would have allowed those banks to provide effective competition even without a branch network. The other major change, which you can see on this picture, was that a large number of building societies and credit unions actually became banks. Some of them are still around today, although some of them have been people like St George, obviously, but some of them have also been absorbed by some of the larger banks along the way. But so you can see there, though, that the share that the banks have in housing credit rose quite dramatically through that period of financial deregulation. But what was going on back through that period of deregulation, though, was that most of the focus of financial institutions was on lending to businesses, not on lending to houses, not on lending for housing. So through the latter part of the 1980s, the share of business loans in banks' total lending rose by 8 percentage points. So the business loans were about nearly two-thirds of all bank loans in that period. So business lending was by far the dominant activity of the banking sector, not lending for housing. But from the early 1990s, a number of factors contributed to the banking system shifting from lending to business back to lending to housing. First of all, the banks they didn't make a whole lot of good business loans in the late 1980s. So they suffered a lot of losses, particularly obviously to a number of well-known entrepreneurs. But during the early 90s recession, so a lot of bad loans on the business front. In contrast, notwithstanding the fact that we had unemployment close to 11%, we had mortgage rates up around 17%, banks didn't suffer many losses on their housing loan portfolio. So their housing loans did really well through the 1990s recession, as I said, notwithstanding the fact that by and large conditions weren't all that great. Second thing which happened after the recession was that the demand for credit from businesses dropped right away, as the business sector underwent a period of deleveraging. The third thing which happened on the regulatory front was the introduction of what was then the first Basel Capital Accord, where at the moment all the talk about bank regulation is effectively around the third variant of the Basel Accord. But the first one saw a change in the risk weighting of assets which favoured housing, in part because housing assets were very safe. So as a result, between 1991 and 1995, the share of business loans in banks' books fell by about 15 percentage points, so a very large swing. Share of housing lending rose to 46%, so just under half of banks' total lending. So that's by the mid-1990s. Since the mid-1990s, that trend has continued in spades, reinforced by the continuing strong performance of housing loans, which I'll come to in a bit later on. So today, the share of housing loans in banks' portfolios stands at about 60%, three-fifths of all bank loans are for housing. The share of business lending is about 35%, with the rest made up by credit cards and the like. So housing is by far the dominant business of the banking sector today. If you go back in the mid-1980s, business was a dominant business of the banking sector. So the next thing I want to talk about, which has direct relevance to you guys, which had a major effect on the structure and in particularly on the pricing of the mortgage market, was the rise of the wholesale lenders. So as nominal interest rates came down in the early 1990s, as we reduced them, mortgage rates declined a lot more slowly. As a result, the spread on banks' housing loans increased. So what I'm going to show you now is a picture of what that looks like going back through time. So what I've got up here, this is mortgage rates relative to the cash rate, and I'll show you the two rates. First of all, the indicator rate, which is the one the banks actually advertise, and then secondly, the actual rate, which is the one people actually pay. So in the early period, there wasn't any difference between the two, and I'll come to that in a minute. But you can see there that spread back in the early 1990s was pretty high, over 400 basis points between the mortgage rate and the cash rate. But as the reduction in inflation and in nominal interest rates eroded the funding advantage that banks had because of interest-free deposits. So if you think about a large bank which has a lot of depositors, particularly pensioners, and the Commonwealth would be a good example of that. A lot of the sort of transaction accounts going back in time paid no interest. So if you're having to pay out zero interest on a large chunk of your deposits and you're earning sort of 13-14% on your mortgage rate, you're doing quite nicely. It's also a very cheap cost of funds. If you had to go to the market and get that money, a lot more expensive. So as inflation came down, still paying zero on the transaction accounts, but you're having to pay less on those other accounts, and that's eroding the cost advantage of a bank which has a large amount of zero interest deposits. So that reduced the bank's funding advantage, but also the wholesale lenders turned up and started competing aggressively for market share by undercutting the bank's mortgage rates and also by introducing new products such as home equity loans, interest-only loans and low-doc loans. So the wholesale lender's share of housing loan approvals rose quickly from 2% in 1993 to 8% by 1996. So what I've got here in the top panel is the share of wholesale lenders in overall housing loan approvals. So you can see it growing quite rapidly there through the 90s, and I'll talk a bit about in a bit later on about what's happened more recently. But you can also see on the bottom panel the other reason why they were able to grow quickly was that mortgage-backed securities became an important source of funding, particularly for wholesale lenders. So the wholesale lenders are in there starting to compete in the early 1990s. The banks didn't just sit there and let that happen. They started to respond to that increased competition by reducing their spreads, as I showed you on the previous graph. So by 1997, the spread on the cash, the spread had come down to about 175 basis points, so from 400 points down to 175. As I said, the ability of the wholesale lenders to compete effectively was considerably helped by the growth of the RMBS market. So the wholesale lenders didn't have a balance sheet. They don't take deposits. They just rely on wholesale funding, then basically from mortgage-backed securities. The fact that they didn't have a balance sheet, they had basically no capital, they don't have a branch network, meant that they were low-cost operations with a large degree of flexibility. If the foreign banks had had that advantage when they came in the 1980s, if mortgage-backed securities had been around, then they probably would have been able to compete more effectively on the housing front. But it sort of took another 10 years or so before that became a viable source of financing. So as the other thing that the banks did to compete against the wholesale lenders was they started offering discounts on the mortgage rate that they were offering to new borrowers. So why did they only do it on new why did they only offer it on the mortgage to new borrowers? It was because if they lower the interest rate for all mortgages, if they lower the interest rate to new borrowers, then they have to lower the interest rate to all borrowers, and that makes their whole mortgage book earn less. If they increase the discount, they only have to increase the discount to the new borrower who comes in the door. So that's the way they competed, was by offering a larger discount to new borrowers as they came in the door. Initially, the banks didn't publicise those discounts that much, but obviously for the last few years they've been quite open about them, and you know, mortgage brokers obviously make that very clear to the borrowers as exactly how large the discount is. Today, the vast majority of new borrowers pay an interest rate that is below the standard variable rate. So the variable rate that the banks actually advertise, basically no one actually borrows at that rate anymore, as I'm sure you're all aware. That discount has also grown over time and basically spread to most borrowers. So our estimate is at the moment that the average borrower out there is receiving a discount of around 60 basis points. Obviously, some are receiving larger ones than that. And that's why there's that gap now between that green rate, the green line, and the orange line. The indicator rate is the rate that the banks are actually advertising. The green rate is the rate that people are actually paying on their mortgages. So by the middle of, by 2007, that spread had basically reached its low point. And you can see the light green line is at its low point in around 2007. As I mentioned earlier, the foreign banks focused on the corporate market when they first began business in the mid-1990s. But from the beginning of this decade, they too have increased their focus on retail banking, including housing lending. Their share of housing loan approvals increased from about 1% in 2000 to a peak of about 15% in 2008. So this is breaking up the loan approvals by four different types of lenders. So the five largest banks, including St George on the top left, the other banks, the other Australian banks, which are basically the three regional banks, the foreign banks, there's a pink line, and you can see that rapid growth. Now, much of that rapid growth was associated with Bank West. Credit unions and building societies, as you can see, have been reasonably constant share of the market once they stopped converting from building societies into banks. And then on the bottom right panel, the wholesale lenders' share, which I showed you earlier. So two related factors helped those foreign banks increase their market share. First of all, the fact that they started off with a small portfolio of mortgages meant that they were able to advertise lower indicator rates without hurting the profitability of a large backbook of mortgages. Secondly, basically, was the rise of the use of the broker network. And the fact that people started becoming much more accustomed to using a broker to find their loans meant that those banks were able to get their products out in front of a large number of people without having a branch network, and the internet also helped them as well. As you can see, though, in late 2008, that pink line drops quite dramatically, and that's basically the drop of Bank West. This is not just because Bank West converted into Commonwealth. Bank West, as you probably know, really cut back on home lending through the second part of 2008, and that's reflected in that large drop in that pink line. So more generally, though, the emergence of mortgage brokers in particular has contributed to the increase in competition between lenders in the Australian mortgage market. So on our estimates, mortgage brokers' share of total mortgage settlements is about one-third of all loans. So you guys are basically involved in about one-third of all housing loans out there. And as I said, outside the major banks, it's enabled all those other banks and wholesale lenders to get their products out easily in front of a large number of people. Let me talk a little bit about product innovation, and there's a written version of this which is on the website, and Suzanne will be able to make available to you, which goes into this in a bit more detail. But obviously through the late 90s and first half of the 2000s, there was considerable product innovation in the mortgage market. Some of that innovation resulted in an easing in lending standards and an increase in risk for both borrowers and lenders, but by and large, its main effect has been to widen the range of households who've been able to access finance. Fortunately, and most importantly, not like in the US, that product innovation lowered lending standards, but they didn't loosen in Australia anywhere near as much as in the US. There was very little subprime lending like that in the US, where loans were provided to those with poor credit histories. So the non-conforming loan market in Australia, which is the sort of closest equivalent to subprime, never reached more than 2% of new loans. It's currently less than 1% of all loans outstanding. If you think about in the US, it was well into double digits, and actually in the middle of 2007, subprime lending was accounting for somewhere between one-fifth and one-third of all loans, of all housing loans in the US. So in Australia, never got more than 2%, currently less than 1%. There are almost no non-conforming loans being issued at the moment, as you're probably aware. The providers of those loans have either exited or gone into extended hibernation. As a result of the fact that we didn't have that big drop in lending standards, and as well as the fact that the Australian economy has pretty much performed better than anyone else over the last couple of years, the share of non-performing housing loans in Australia has remained very low. So let me just show you a little bit about that. So what I've got here is non-performing housing loans in a few different countries going back a while. So you can see Australia, and as you also see Canada, which has a banking system and, in fact, a mortgage market very similar to ours, you can see that non-performing loans less than 0.5% of all loans and basically hasn't moved for the last 10, 15 years. You can see there in the US it's as high as 8% and still rising. You can also see in Spain up around 3.5%, the UK around 3%. Not entirely clear that those two have topped out yet either. So the Australian performance on arrears rates on non-performing housing loans is markedly better than almost any other country in the world, with the exception of Canada, which has had a very similar experience. Australian residential mortgage-backed securities have continued to perform very well. No one has suffered any losses on an Australian RMBS, as the insurance that's involved in an RMBS, as well as the fact that the loan performance has been very good, together with the subordination in the RMBS, has provided a more than adequate buffer. So you would have thought, given the Australian mortgage market would have been reasonably unaffected by the financial crisis, but as Phil alluded to earlier, that hasn't been the case, as you're obviously all well aware. So the financial crisis obviously had a big effect on pricing and structure in the mortgage market. The one thing it hasn't had on a particularly big effect on, though, is the supply of credit. Credit's continued to grow at a reasonable pace throughout. So beginning around the middle of 2007, there was a widespread reassessment of risk. Securitisation started to suffer severe brand damage as US RMBS incurred significant credit problems as those delinquency rates began to rise. So while the problems were initially in the subprime market in the US, it's now spread to the prime market as well. I think prime arrears rates are sort of 5-6% at the moment in the US, and again, it looks like they're still rising. So the Australian RMBS market, despite the fact that it's done really well, was significantly affected. Even though the lending standards were much better here, no one suffered any losses, still suffered a lot of fallout. Issuance dried up markedly. So what I've got here on the top, I'll come back to the pricing, which is on the top line at the moment, but if you look at the bottom line, that's the amount of RMBS which are issued every quarter in the Australian market. So you can see in mid-2007, sort of 15, 20 billion a quarter. Second half of 2000 almost dries up completely. And through the whole of 2008, very, very low issuance. So most of the issuance over the through late 08 and the first bit of 2009 was purchased by the Australian government through the AOFM's support program. One problem which was going on was that offshore structured investment vehicles, or SIVs as they're known, which had been large buyers of Australian RMBS prior to the financial crisis, basically disappeared. And they were forced to sell their portfolios, so they had a lot of bad US RMBS in their portfolio, had a lot of good Australian RMBS in their portfolio. They were forced to liquidate because they were going broke and they were running out of funding, had to sell all of their portfolio. And then as they sold their portfolio of Australian mortgages, that drove up the spread on Australian mortgage-backed securities, and that's that light blue line at the top. So if you wanted to go out and buy, if you're looking to invest in Australian mortgage-backed security, you could buy one very, very cheaply off one of those guys. There was no need for you to go out and buy a new mortgage-backed security off a wholesale lender. There was plenty of good quality, cheap mortgage-backed securities in the secondary market. So, as I said, that drove those spreads on mortgage-backed securities from about 15 basis points to 400 basis points, which made issuing a new mortgage-backed security completely uneconomic. And as a result, issuance just stopped. The crisis also had a major effect on funding costs of all the providers in the mortgage market. So in addition to affecting the RMBS market, retail funding costs, and the most obvious example of that at the moment, is deposit rates, have risen also considerably. So in response to the rise in funding costs, all institutions, both banks and non-banks, have raised their mortgage rates relative to the cash rate. The average rate on outstanding variable rate housing loans has increased by around 110 basis points relative to the cash rate, which we set, since mid-2007. So what I've got here is the spread between a few different types of loan rates and the cash rate. So you can see the housing loan rate's gone up by about 110 basis points. In that sort of bluish colour, you can see our estimate of banks' funding costs. That shows you that banks' funding costs have gone up by about as much as the housing loan rate. You can see the business loan rates have generally gone up by more than our estimate of banks' funding costs. So while housing loan rates have gone up relative to the cash rate, we don't think they've moved that much relative to funding costs, but business loan rates have generally gone up by a reasonable amount more. So because the funding costs of the smaller participants in the market had risen by even more than this, their profits have been squeezed by more. And so in some cases, the ability of those smaller players to provide new loans has been curtailed, and you've probably seen that in terms of how much lending they've been willing to do over the last couple of years. Some of those smaller lenders, though, have been able to remain competitive and profitable only by cross-subsidising their new issuance using the large spread they're earning on their back book. So if you look, the mortgages they wrote prior to 2007 were issued at a very issued when funding costs were considerably lower. As they've repriced their mortgages up, they've repriced their whole mortgage book up, and that's made those older mortgages quite profitable. So the pressure on funding during the crisis, together with the near closure of the RMBS market, has changed the competitive dynamic in the mortgage market. The market share of wholesale lenders has fallen from 13% in mid-2007 to be only about 2% by early 2009. Obviously, several of the large wholesale lenders, such as Challenger, were acquired by the major banks. Wizard, another example. RAMS. The share of housing loan approvals by the smaller banks, credit unions and building societies also declined, although not as sharply as the wholesale lenders. So at the moment, the major banks' combined market share rose from 60% sort of mid-2007 to be about 80%, or a bit over 80% now. So while the composition of the mortgage market has changed quite dramatically, with the banks now issuing the bulk of new mortgages, the supply of housing credit has generally been perfectly adequate and readily available throughout the period. So housing credit has continued to grow at about 8% a year over the last year, 18 months. So the larger banks have basically filled the gap left by the decline of the wholesale lenders. So unlike in some other countries, we haven't had a material constraint on the quantity of housing credit available throughout the crisis. Obviously, as you've probably been aware over the last 6 months or so, there's been some tightening in lending standards. Most of the banks have reduced their maximum LVRs, particularly for first home buyers. Banks have also raised their interest rate buffers and increased their genuine savings requirements. So You have to have demonstrated a bit of a savings history with a bank. Just getting your money from your mum or your dad is not demonstrating savings. So those sort of standards have tightened up quite a bit, as I said, particularly in the first home buyer. So let me talk a little bit about the future, which I think looks reasonable. And I hope, to some extent, I want to try and draw on where we've come from. So you said where the market is, whether what market was in 2007 was obviously dramatically different from where it was even in the early 90s in terms of the more wholesale lenders being there, in terms of the foreign banks being there. Obviously, we've shifted back a bit with the banks increasing their share again. But going forward, I think the market is still looking reasonably competitive. In fact, the competitive state of the housing market at the moment is reflected in the fact that home lending rates haven't risen by as much as funding costs. To some extent, I think if the market had been uncompetitive, the banks would have been, you would have seen mortgage rates potentially go up by even more. Moreover, the outlook for the smaller lenders has improved since mid-2009. So if I go back to the securitisation graph, you can see there those light green bars, which are the non-AOFM issuance of RMBS, have started to pick up, particularly in the first quarter of this year. So we're seeing investors starting to come back into the market. So securitisation is again becoming a more viable funding source for lenders, with spreads, as you can see in the top part, coming down to where we roughly think it's about break-even or slightly profitable. Now, it partly depends on what sort of institution you are, but certainly securitisation is now a competitive source of funding. If I think about a bank having to go out and borrow money at 4 or 5 years, the price they can borrow at is about the same as they can issue an RMBS. So if you're relying on RMBS funding, you've got that sort of 4 or 5 year funding. It's about the same cost to you as a bank raising 4 or 5 year money in the wholesale market. So the cost of also the cost of long-term and short-term wholesale funding has decreased since mid-2009, although going the other direction, there's been obviously aggressive competition for deposits, which has pushed up that source of funding costs. So the smaller lenders' market shares has risen slightly over the last couple of months, although I don't think, and as Phil said earlier, the market isn't going to go back to where it was in 2007. I don't see the smaller lenders having the same sort of market share they had in 2007 anytime soon. And one reason for that is that the pre-crisis level of RMBS, the sort of $20 billion a quarter issuance back then, was supported by demand from those offshore sieves who are just simply not there anymore. So a lot of the buyers of those mortgage-backed securities just aren't around anymore. But as the major banks have increased their lending rates to recoup their increased funding costs, and as the funding cost of a securitisation has fallen, the smaller participants have become more competitive and are continuing to become more competitive. The other important thing to point out when we're talking about mortgage rates going up by more than the cash rate is that while that's happened, we take that well and truly into account in our policy, or the board takes that into account in its policy deliberations. So when we set the cash rate, we're mindful of the fact that the lending rates do not move one for one with the cash rate. In fact, the period in which they did that, sort of through the 90s and early part of this decade, was somewhat unusual relative to the history. So we are still the major determinant of the interest rate structure in Australia, even though lending rates are at times move not in lockstep with the cash rate. The major influence on banks' lending rates still is the cash rate, but it's just not the only influence. So with the securitisation market showing greater volatility in recent months, I think the housing loan market still remains contestable. Any widening in margins from here is likely to attract new competition into the market, and you've seen some new players starting to resurface. One of the sponsors today, Vow, is an example of that. So some of those guys are coming back into the market. You're seeing Aussie looking at coming back into the market again. And some of the other brokers looking to increase their own mortgage lending again. So with those developments, I'm pretty confident that the supply of mortgage credit in Australia is likely to continue to be adequate, so provide plenty of business for you guys in a competitive marketplace. So let me finish there. As I said, I think it's a reasonably optimistic picture. You shouldn't, as Phil said, be looking for the market to go back to where it was in 2007, but I still think we've got a reasonable number of players still out there, and I think some of those smaller players are going to become increasingly more viable as we go forward from here, as long as the improvement in financial markets that we've seen over the last couple of years continues. So I'll finish there and happy to take some questions that you might have. So far, it hasn't had any effect at all, actually, so far being up until last night. So we've had, you know, the past 3 or 4 months, there's obviously been a lot of concerns about Greece and other countries in Europe. It's pretty much been confined to Europe. So we've seen Greek borrowing costs and borrowing costs of some other countries in Europe go up quite a lot. But we haven't seen any effect on, you know, say, for instance, the ability of the Australian banks funding costs or on even on, you know, through the first quarter of this year, as I said, mortgage-backed securities, there's been plenty of demand for that. So it's been fairly localised to Europe thus far, and one would hope that it remains so. Somewhat difficult to predict how exactly that's going to unfold, and it seems to have got a bit more messy in the past 24 hours. But to date, it's been fairly localised within Europe, hasn't really affected other, hasn't affected bank funding markets or even countries outside the European region. So, you know, obviously if financial markets deteriorate, some of these things are going to go back, but thus far that hasn't happened. I know nothing about what's in the Henry Review, as much as you do, which is probably from reading the newspaper. So I don't, not really in much position to comment. I think one thing which has obviously got a lot of the press is taxation of deposits, which obviously that has an impact on funding, which would potentially flow through to the housing market. So that's another potential avenue, which might have some effect. No, I can't tell you where rates are going to go. That's the one question I won't answer. Let me just say one thing about fixed rates, which I that was a good way of trying to get me to ask that question indirectly. One thing which is interesting about fixed rates, which you guys have probably seen, at the moment, fixed rate loans in terms of new loans are barely 2%. So, and that's been true for at least 6 months. So we've seen people aren't interested really in taking out a fixed rate loan at the moment. So the stock of the share of fixed rate loans in the total stock has actually come down quite a bit as well, just because there hasn't been really many new fixed rate loans issued in the last while. The other thing which is interesting I always find in the Australian market is if I was standing here in the US and we're talking about a fixed rate loan, we'd be talking about a loan which is fixed for 30 years. And in Australia, sometimes fixed rate loan means, you know, 2 years, and if you're lucky, maybe it means 3 or 5 years. So sort of, which has an impact actually on the way that monetary policy works here. So when we change the cash rate and mortgage rates change, it affects everyone pretty much straight away. You know, even the people on fixed rate loans affects within a year or two. Whereas in the US, most people on a 30-year fixed rate loan, when the central bank changes the rate there, that has a much less of an impact on mortgage rates there. So to some extent, it makes monetary policy a lot more effective, you know, at least through that channel, a lot more potent and direct in Australia than it does in the US. No, so yeah, we do. But one thing on the US, so you don't pay a break cost when you break the loan in the US, but you basically pay for it when you take out your loan. So the 30-year fixed rate is higher than it would otherwise be by 50, 60 basis points, I think is the rough estimate, because of the option value you have of being able to break whenever you want. So you don't actually pay a fee when you break, but you've sort of already paid it the whole way through. So as I said, we have a good sense of the flow of fixed rate loans, and as I said earlier, it's about 2% at the moment. In terms of the stock, we don't have quite as hard numbers, but we have reasonable numbers. At the moment, we think it's somewhere between about 15 and 20% of all loans are fixed. But because they're not fixed for very long, obviously that stock turns over quite rapidly. And with the share of new loans being very, of fixed rates in new loans being very low at the moment, that stock's dropping quite rapidly. I talked a bit about that just recently, about the sort of small business finance, most of which are obviously residentially secured. And there had been, the banks had certainly tightened their lending standards or lending conditions on small business over the last couple of years. I think you're seeing some sign of that easing now, only in the last in the last few months and seeing a little more the banks starting to push back, you know, go back into that market. I mean, to some extent, going back, say, a year, 18 months, you know, the outlook wasn't looking that rosy. You know, our expectation of where the economy would be now was a lot less strong than where it actually is, and that was shared by a lot of people and also by the banks, and so they pulled back on lending, particularly to business. Turns out the economy's come along a lot better than everyone expected, and so now you're starting to see a reassessment of those lending standards and seeing some of that ease again. Well, rather than I won't talk about individual parts of the program, but they, but at least did the fiscal stimulus help support the economy? Yes, it did. So the we had a large fiscal stimulus and a large monetary stimulus, and some of the strength in the economy we've seen is certainly attributable to that. And obviously, we've had other things which have helped us too. The fact that China likes buying stuff we have in the ground is obviously fairly beneficial for us, and we're starting to see, you know, and that's certainly continuing in spades. But the combination of all those things, the reason why Australia did well was those things, plus the fact that our banking system actually was in good shape, so that when we reduced our when the RBA reduced the cash rate, mortgage rates did come down. In other countries, mortgage rates didn't fall nearly as much, and so monetary policy transmission was effective here because the financial system was in good shape. You know, the banks were still out there lending for housing. That hasn't been the case in the North Atlantic. The housing credit's actually gone backwards in most countries there. Here it's grown by 8%, not growing by 20%, which was growing in 2007, but still growing at a pretty solid clip. So the fact that we had a strong banking sector, large fiscal monetary stimulus, decent, China buying our minerals, all helped to, leave us in the position that we're in today. I mean, so the interest rate is set for the economy as a whole. So, and we've only got one of them, so we can only set the one instrument for the economy as a whole. So we have to take the bits which are, to some extent, you have to be careful, I think, about overstating the sort of two-speed economy. The strongest part of the country at the moment in terms of the decline in unemployment, when you look at it in terms of house prices and whatever, Melbourne. Now, not too many mines in Melbourne or in Victoria, but there's a lot of mining companies in Victoria. So, the fact, obviously there are more, there's probably more job opportunities in WA or in parts of Queensland, or in, I come from Adelaide, so despite most people are unaware of the fact that South Australia also has a decent amount of mining there too. But, it's slightly more widespread, and it spreads out through the economy more than you might think. So if you go back to 2007, when we're not the similar situation where we are today, we had that mining wealth, the wealth coming through the mining sector did tend to spread through the whole economy. So, but in the end, as I said, we've only got the one interest rate which we have to set for the aggregate of the economy. So we have to add up the bits which are growing faster and the bits which are growing slower. And at different times over the past 15, 20 years, there have been different parts of the economy growing faster and different parts growing slowly. I mean, if I go back to 1999, and this is relevant because of where we're actually having to be sitting now, parts of Australia were complaining because they thought that interest rates were rising purely because of the building boom, because of the Sydney Olympics. So at different parts of, different points in time, there are always parts of the economy which are growing faster and other parts which are growing slowly. We just, as I said, we sort of add them up and come, look at the national, at what's going on at the national level and set policy on the basis of that. But, in doing so, we're looking at what's going on in the different parts. So we don't just look at the aggregate, we look at all the detail as well. So, but in the end, as I said, we have the one instrument which we adjust to calibrate, which we calibrate for the strength of the economy as a whole. We know that at some point high inflation is detrimental to growth. Now, can I tell you that it's if you looked at, say, if you go back again to the 70s and 80s here when we had higher inflation, sort of 8-10%, that generally wasn't helpful for the functioning of the economy. So we know at some point inflation too high inflation is a problem. Can I tell you that it's 2 to 3% rather than, you know, some number, you know, it's 2.5% and not 3.5%? Precisely, no. But we are... But when you've got low and stable inflation like we've had for the past 15 years, I mean, to some extent, having inflation so that no one really pays that much attention to it, which is roughly what's been the case for the last 15 years, and keeping it low and stable, you know, helps deliver an environment which allows the economy to grow the fastest. Now, what exactly that rate is often difficult to tell, but, you know, we've had strong economic outcomes over the last decade or so with with inflation at that level, which seems a reasonable case to, you know, continue to do so going forward. To some extent, I think we're at, as I sort of said during the speech, we're at a point where, and part of the reason why I went through that history was to, you know, show you just how much that market share has swung over the past 3 or 4 decades. So we're at a point at the moment where the share of the 4 major banks is as high as it's been. But as I said, I think there are reasons to think that we're probably at the peak and we'll start to go back. I mean, as I said, ultimately, you know, what we care about is where the level of borrowing rates is, not necessarily who's setting the rate which gets it there. But, you know, it's something we certainly keep an eye on. But as I said, it's swung through a long way through history. My guess is it's probably about at its peak now, and we'll start. You know, I think you'll start to see that share. In fact, you're already seeing signs of that share declining. Yeah, and I suppose Yeah. So one thing which is sort of interesting is that, you know, you can see from here that the spread to the cash rate has risen. If I showed you this relative to funding costs, you would have seen that relative to funding costs, it actually hasn't risen much at all. And in fact, where things were in 2007, mortgage spreads were as low as they'd ever ever been. So, and for a whole bunch of reasons, I think we're not going to go back to where we were in the middle of 2007 because there were parts of the market structure back then which were probably unsustainable. So have we moved away from that? Yeah, we have, but we're certainly, you know, we're not back where we were in 1994 either. And as I said, you know, you're starting to see some people returning to the market because it's becoming attractive for them to do so. And I think the experience of the last 10 or 15 years shows you that when things start to get, when margins start to increase a little too much, there are plenty of people out there who are able to come in and take advantage of that. Maybe not quite so many now as there were 3 or 4 years ago, but there's still a decent number of them around. I think I'll defer mostly to the... as someone who's actually looking for a house at the moment myself, yes, but... yes, I do. So I have availed myself to your network. I won't give him a free plug, I'll pass on that one because Glenn said a fair bit about that of late. Credit card rates are something I'm going to pass the buck on that one because that's not something I know quite so much about. You can ask, if you ever get the chance to talk to one of my colleagues who looks after that side, Malcolm Eder, you can ask him that question. So I'll pass on that one. Relevant to what I said earlier, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, obviously there was a lot more regulation of particular rates, and we've moved a long way away from that over the past 2 or 3 decades. So, I mean, do we look at it? Yes. Is it something, we don't go and tell the banks what they should be doing on the prices of their different products? Everything. I mean, one of the important, one of the important inputs into the whole process is we have an extensive liaison program. So the data we get is often a little bit, obviously looks at the history, but to try and get a sense of where things are at the moment, we have an extensive business liaison program right around the country. Offices in the different capital cities which go out and spend their whole time talking to businesses. So that's an important input. But as I was saying earlier, though, ultimately the CPI and where it's going, or the inflation and where it's going, is an important input. But everything basically feeds into that assessment of the state of the economy. So it's really hard to single out any one particular piece of information. There's a hell of a lot of information, both hard data from the statistician, but also the sort of softer data we get from our extensive liaison program. Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I go back to what I said a couple of times, and I said it a few times when I spoke to MFAA functions down in Melbourne, is that, you know, you have to be careful about thinking about where the business... So the business outlook looks pretty... You know, the sort of 7 or 8% growth in housing credit we're seeing at the moment, you know, that may well be where we're going to be for the next while, rather than the sort of 20% growth that we were seeing 06 and 07. So in terms of thinking about where the market's going to go back to, you shouldn't think it's going to go back to where it was in 2007. But that said, the economic outlook for Australia, you know, is reasonable. You would expect that associated with that, you'd have reasonable growth in housing credit. You're starting to see a few more players come back into the housing market. But I think, you know, it goes back to partly what Phil was saying about the regulation of in the industry. You know, if you think back in 2006 and 2007, there were sort of some fringe players in the market, both in the lending side and also in the broking side, which probably weren't necessarily good for the industry as a whole. We've had a bit of a shakeout of that, and which I think people in this room are probably happier to see rather than anything else. And so for the core part of the industry, I think the outlook is actually pretty reasonable going forward.